Oh, trick-or-treaters.
Get the candy.
Trick-or-treat.
Look at these costumes. We've got a vampire.
And a witch.
And what are you?
Oh, I'm an apple pie.
Radio Catskill has more tasty terror than you've ever seen at Apple Pie Paloozaween.
That sounds like a lot of pie.
A frightful amount of apple pie. There's pie to eat, pie to buy, for ghouls and gourmets alike. You're sure to savor every bootiful bite.
That pun was kind of scary.
It sure was.
Apple Pie Paloozaween, frightfully good fun to support Radio Catskill. 2 to 5 this afternoon, Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Happy Apple Pie Paloozaween!
It's all right if you wear a costume, too.
Modern pop and rock songs can be transformed by a little focused imagination into something new and special. Next time on The Waggleload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, focused reworkings of pop and rock songs on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg, with today's guest, the world-renowned mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe, who just so happens to live right here in Pike County, Pennsylvania. You know, I enjoy all my guests. I've laughed, I've cried, I've learned so much in the almost 10 years that Catskill Character has been on the air. But I do especially love it when it turns out that a guest was born and bred right here in the Catskills, which is true for Stephanie, who hails from Mongop Valley and graduated from Monticello High School. In the first half of the show, we'll talk about that and Stephanie's career as one of the most critically acclaimed artists of her generation. Notice I didn't just say opera singer, and that's because she does other things besides her operatic performances, including performing rock and roll songs as her alter ego, Blythely Oratonio, who she will tell us all about. Please enjoy my conversation with Stephanie Blythe. Let's get to it. Welcome to Catskill Character, Stephanie. I am so pleased to have you on my show today.
Thank you very, very much. It's lovely to be here with you.
Your mother was a linguist, and she was an amazing fan of culture, as you told me. So I'm assuming that she brought you to see art and music and theater. Is that correct?
My mother introduced me to art and music and theater at home. We didn't do a lot of traveling. First time I went to New York to see a show was my high school choral director that took me. But my mother did introduce me to things like poetry and painting, and she loved collecting books of art. She also introduced me to opera for the first time via PBS. Public broadcasting, extremely important to my childhood. And I remember watching Tosca for the first time with her and hearing this aria that just completely knocked me out. And I said, Mom, please, can you write that for me? So she wrote it out, E lucevan le stelle, which is Mario Cavaradossi's last big aria in the final act of Tosca. And I memorized that aria, and it was incredibly important for me. It was a real touchstone.
And public radio, public TV remained just as important today, if not more important.
Oh, yeah. And because of PBS, I remember in junior high being asked who my favorite singer was. And I said, Luciano Pavarotti. And everyone made fun of me. Well, and how many years later I was singing with him at the Met. So,
oh my God,
you never know what's going to happen.
You put it out there and
I manifested it.
You manifested it.
I manifested it. I was introduced to some of the most important people in the industry on PBS and ended up working with a lot of people that I really admired, which is a blessing.
Your father was a jazz musician, and he played all the major hotels up here in the Catskills. I was wondering if, as a child, you ever went with him to see him perform.
I went with him to the Concord several times to pick up his paycheck. I never saw him play there.
Before we talk about your career, let's discuss your music education at Monticello High School. When you told me about it, it really blew me away.
I was very, very fortunate. My elementary music teacher was an amazing man named Dominic Dorio, who made a huge impression on me. In junior high, I joined the band. And then when I went to high school, I was fortunate enough to be in the band. I was in the orchestra. I played flute. I played flute in the concert band, orchestra. I played baritone saxophone in the stage band. I was in the mixed chorus. Every year we did a play. Every year we did a musical. And I did the play and the musical every single year. It really was a truly, truly life-changing experience. And my high school music director was a guy named Steve Rovitz, who was absolutely wonderful to me and gave me a real great basis for my music education. And my high school choral director, Martin Banner, who is still a dear friend, is the reason that I went to the Crane School of Music, because he was a graduate of the Crane School of Music at SUNY Potsdam. And I studied with his voice teacher. And when I won the Met competition in 1994, Pat Mislin, who was his teacher and my teacher, and Martin were sitting on either side of me.
Beautiful.
So that was really, you know, it was, I have a lot of moments in my life that are very full circle. I will never forget that. It was a really poignant moment.
You just mentioned that you went to the Crane School of Music at SUNY Potsdam, and you have degrees in English and music.
Yes.
You've been associated with the Metropolitan Opera in New York City since your debut there in 1995. Now, Stephanie, that's only 3 years after graduation from college. Is yes. that a typical trajectory?
Absolutely not. But I will elaborate a tiny bit on that and say there is no typical trajectory for any kind of artist. There isn't. I have parents who I talk to all the time who want to know, okay, well, what steps do we have to take and what's the next thing they have to do? There is no prescribed way to do this. When I was coming up, it was a general thing that you'd get your music degree and then you would go into a young artist program and become a professional singer that way in opera. But really, there are tons of ways to go about doing this. Mm. Was it unusual to go to the Met at 23, 24? Yes. Were there other people there with me that were doing that? Yes. But I never got a graduate degree. I have an honorary doctorate from SUNY Potsdam, which I'm very proud of. But my graduate program was being a young artist at the Metropolitan. And I just stayed. It's my home company. I have really, really loved the time that I've spent there. And I look forward to going back.
Well, you know, I would love to list all the roles and the venues you've played, but this is a half-hour show, as we know. In the 2020s, you started performing male roles under the drag persona Blithely Oratonio. How and why did this come about?
Two reasons. First reason is menopause. My voice changed. I lost the very top of my voice and I gained an enormous amount on the bottom of my voice. I've always had a low voice to begin with, but it got lower. And then I was introduced to some really amazing drag performers in Philadelphia. My dear, dear friend, Dido Van Rygersburg, also known as Martha Graham Cracker, and my dear friend, John Jarbo, who is my drag director and the music director is a wonderful guy named Dan Kazemi. John is my director and co-writer. So every time done a drag show, the script is written by the two of us. And we do a lot of wonderful improv and writing and all sorts of terrific stuff together. And we develop these shows. And so it became interesting when Chicago Opera Theater came to me and said, we'd like you to do a show as Blithely Oratonio and a tenor role. Would you? And they invited me to sing Don Jose in Carmen. I was thrilled to do that. It's been a dream of mine to sing that role. My other dream is to sing Mario Cavaradossi for the reasons that you now understand, that it's a very important role to my life and loving opera. But in my drag show, I sing a lot of tenor roles. And then a couple of years ago, I went to San Diego Opera and performed the title role in Gianni Schicchi alongside the role of La Principessa in Suor Angelica. So I did one opera as a woman and one opera as a man.
What was that like, switching back and forth? Like,
easy.
Was it seamless?
It was easy.
Ah.
Because I had an incredible support system. My dear friend Eva Bell was conducting and he was magnificent and everyone around me was supportive and wonderful.
I did see your show, Blithely Ever After. It was on PBS. You performed it at Lincoln Center, and you've said that there's a lot of Stephanie in that show.
Oh, yeah. It's a very, very autobiographical show. And there's a lot of teenage angst that's worked out in it. It's lovely because it's about someone becoming someone they've always wanted to be and using music to get there. It's wonderful. Yeah, it's about an opera singer who wants to be a rock star.
I would love it if you would just tell the listener what some of those songs are.
We do a lot of mashing up opera and popular music. For instance, the whole thing opens with me singing Nessun Dorma from Turandot, which is one of the most famous tenor arias ever. And it moves into Queen. There's a really wonderful number that I love that we've developed from other shows of Vesti la Giubba from Pagliacci with Send in the Clowns. Pagliacci is a clown. So it's probably one of the most, I don't want to say angry, but there's a lot of angst in it, and it works out really beautifully. And also, one of my favorite things on that show, there's a really lovely number that we do that's my favorite Captain and Tennille song, Gentle Stranger, which is a love song to the audience. I've always loved that song. When we were looking for a song to tell that story, that was immediately what we went to, and it's one of my favorite things to sing.
And I want to give a shout out to your costume designer. You come out in this incredible headpiece with matching cape, and the headpiece is huge. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, oh my God, look at that. And then I realized, wait a second, those are plastic garbage bags.
Yep, the shredded hefty bags.
Shredded hefty bags. And how brilliant is that? First of all, that it looks so fabulous, but then it wasn't heavy.
Well, it makes total sense if you know who the designer is. It's the designer's Machine Dazzle, and
Machine Dazzle.
Machine Dazzle and the yeah, he, Machine is in extraordinary, and actually has performed in some of my shows, at least one of them. And is just a larger than life person whose essence is distilled into these fantastic, unbelievable shapes and incredibly diverse materials into his work. It's quite something. And the costume that I wear is built by a magnificent artist named Rebecca Canik in Philadelphia. So I'm really, really lucky to have been introduced to these folks.
In 2019, you began as the artistic director of the Bard College Conservatory of Music in the Graduate Vocal Arts program. What's the best part of teaching for you?
The best part of teaching is being a witness to an artist, a young artist developing, being part of that journey. That's the best part. But more than that, it's watching them take the next steps on their own and to see how that all develops. I'm really fortunate because I have a phenomenal support system, a great support system at our program at Bard. And the students that I've had the opportunity to work with to a person have been marvelous. I'm a very effusive human being, and I use a lot of I use a lot of words like incredible and marvelous and amazing. I do that for a reason because they just are.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I'm very, very lucky to teach. I never, I went to school to become a teacher. And I decided that I didn't want to teach after a year of studying to become a teacher. Like everything in my life, I came to it organically. It just came to me at the right moment in my life. I got that job a semester before the pandemic hit. That was amazing. Because I had a job. I lost all my contracts like every other singer out there. So I continued to work. And not only did I continue to work, but I continued to work in a very, very hopeful industry, working with young people starting out. And that experience lifted me up in a way I really needed at the time. Because when you feel low, the thing that is the best medicine for that is helping somebody else. And that really, really, really helped.
Well, what a perfect spot to end the first part of the show. And we can take a break and then we'll come back and talk some more. You've been listening to Catskill Character with me, your host, Donna Fellenberg, and my guest, Stephanie Blythe. We'll be right back.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Jelani Cobb, Dean of Columbia Journalism School and a staff writer at The New Yorker. He'll talk about the current state of journalism and offer an insider's perspective on relations between universities and the Trump administration. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Alex Edelman explained he never picks up those social cues saying it's time to go home.
But for me, the party starts when people are upset that I'm there.
I'm Peter Sagal. You'll never want this week's news quiz to end with special guest actor, influencer, and fashion icon Julia Fox. You're invited to an exclusive news quiz. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. If you've just joined us, today's guest is mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe, who lives in Pike County. In the first half of the show, Stephanie told us about her background, her singing career, and her alter ego, Blythely Oratonio. In the second half of the show, she'll tell us about playing the ukulele and share some stories about her late husband, David Smith Larson. I love you because I have always loved you. I will find you because I have always found you. Stephanie, you woke up recently with those words in your head. They're just so beautiful. And they were about, of course, your late husband, the love of your life, David Smith Larson, who died just this past October. But you told me you like talking about David, so we're going to talk about him. Yep. Let's begin by telling the listener how you met.
We met in late October 1999 at the Paris Opera. I was making my debut as Mistress Quickly in Falstaff, and David was doing the non-singing acting role of the innkeeper. I walked into my first rehearsal. I saw this gentleman walking towards me. And of course, I was working in a French theater for the very first time. I did not speak an enormous amount of French, and I was very, very nervous about meeting everyone, sort of leaning very heavily on my American counterparts there. Fortunately, one of my colleagues at the Met was also in that show, Christine Gerke, so we hung out together, and that was really wonderful. But I saw this guy walking towards me. He was wearing jeans and a white shirt with blue stripes. I heard him speaking English with an English accent. And I thought, ooh, he looks interesting. And they came up to me and said that the wig master wanted to talk to me. And they wanted me to play Mistress Quickly as an old woman. So they were trying these gray wigs on me. And I was trying to explain to them in my broken French that I didn't play Quickly as an older woman, that I thought she was perfectly fine at my age. And I was having a very difficult time getting that across to everyone. And this guy came over and he explained it to them very clearly. And that was it. He was very interested in me from the get-go. There's a really, really great music store right next to the Paris Opera called Finac. I was a sponge. I needed to have all of that music. And he would constantly look and see what I bought. And he was so shocked at what this 30-year-old American was listening to. That's how it all began. I'd come into work and he'd look and see what I was reading or what I was listening to. It was love at first sight. He always said to me, the first time I saw you, I thought, man, this is trouble. Something's going to happen here. He was right. He believed very fervently this was not our first time around. I believe it too. And when I went to sleep the other night and I heard those words in my head, I thought, oh, honey, you're telling me again. That's what I ask for every night. I need to find you again. And I know we will at some point, in some time continuum, we're going to be together again.
He lived in Paris for, did you say 35 years?
35 years, yes.
He was very sophisticated. And people may not necessarily think of that when they think of professional wrestlers.
He was a professional wrestler for a very, very long time. But you have to think that professional wrestlers a lot of travel. There's a lot of time in that travel to do things like read, which he did. He was a voracious reader and he was a great student of history. He knew more European history than you could possibly imagine. And he knew more about World War II than anybody. That was his time period. And of course, he lived through it. He lived through it. He grew up in Portsmouth, England, in the maritime capital of the UK, and started out as a kid working in the dockyard. And he knew all that stuff. Mm. And he also knew that he wanted to leave and that he didn't want to work in a dockyard for his whole life. So he started doing weightlifting when he was very, very young at a guy named Bob Wolger's gym, very famous gym. And he just started doing bodybuilding. It morphed eventually into wrestling, and he was very, very successful. He wrestled both as Dave Larson, and he wrestled under the name Zarok, which was a name that he created for himself, and also occasionally as the White Angel or L'Ange Blanc, depending on where he was. And he ended up doing his thing in Paris. And then he stayed there. When he finished wrestling, he ended up doing bodyguarding. So he bodyguarded all sorts of people, like David Bowie or Ella Fitzgerald and Nana Mouskouri, or sometimes for British dignitaries. Then he needed to have a hip replacement. So he was off of the books for long enough that, you know, getting back in was difficult. And he met a friend on the street who said, "Hey, what are you doing?" And David said nothing. And his friend said, "Well, why don't you come and see me in the opera? Come and see what I do." And he went and watched his friend be a supernumerary. He took David to an audition at Le Châtelet, which is one of the opera theaters in Paris, and he got a role. And he started doing supernumerary work in 1995. And then 4 years plus later, we met in the Paris Opera.
How the heck did you end up in the Poconos?
When we decided to get married, I said to him, "Where do you want to live? I would have been happy to relocate to Paris." And he said, "No, I'll come to the United States. I've always wanted to live there." So he came and lived with me in New York City on the Upper West Side. We were there for 2 years. And I said to him, "Look, I've lived in New York City for 10 years now, and I'm done. We work in so many cities, we don't need to live in a city. And I thought it would be nice to own a home." So I said, "I know you always wanted to retire to Provence, but would the Poconos do?" And he said, "Absolutely." And we came out here in early 2004 and never looked back. He loved it. And I love it here. He adored this country, and we traveled all over it. We started driving across country probably around 2012, loaded up our dogs in the minivan, and we drove cross country at least a dozen times. We were always enamored with any place that we were. I would say that his favorite place was Tucson, Arizona. He loved the desert. Great for his arthritis. And we also were avid bird watchers. So all of that traveling was great for bird watching. With the house that we bought, we chose it in large part due to the fact that when we walked in the backyard, the bird feeding station was covered in chickadees. And Dave was like, "We got to be here. We got to be here." That's all we needed to see. It was really, really wonderful. And it still is. The birds are actually a great comfort to me. In fact, not long after he died, I was out on our back patio and a chickadee flew past me and it hit the window. And then it landed in a raised bed that I have and that I was standing right there. It landed like 2 feet from me. And I just reached down and it jumped onto my hand. And then I put it on my shoulder and it sat there for a good 10 minutes. I put my head over to the side and it touched me with its own head. And I thought, you know, good gracious, of course, honey, you're visiting me through this bird. It makes total sense that it would be a chickadee. There are lots of different stories about people being visited through birds. So I thought that was very poignant.
Let's talk a minute about the ukulele. I know that you used to play the ukulele for David every night when he went to sleep. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about your ukulele experience and how it started?
It started because I was doing a cabaret show about the great Kate Smith with my friend Craig Terry. At one point I said to him, "I really should learn to play one of these songs on the ukulele because so many of these songs were written on the ukulele." And opening night of our show that we did for Lincoln Center, he gave me a ukulele. So I had this thing for a few years and I thought, I've really got to learn to play this. And I brought it with me a couple of years later to Tanglewood, where I was working for the summer. And I'm sitting in the living room playing this soprano ukulele and thinking, oh man, you know, these meat hooks holding onto this thing, this is ridiculous. It's too small. I was tuning it. G-string broke, which I thought was hysterical. It made me end up going to Amazon looking for new strings. And I saw that ukuleles have different sizes. And I thought, oh, maybe I could find a larger ukulele. So I got myself a tenor ukulele and it arrived and I learned a few chords on it. And I thought, this is a lot of fun. And David said, "Hey, you can really do that. Why didn't you really work on it?" So I did. And now I own 14 ukuleles. And I am a spokesperson for Lonnie Kai ukulele, which is the only ukulele that I play in concert. And I absolutely love that ukulele. I have several Lonnie Kais, but I generally play on the blue quilted maple tenor. It's just beautiful to play. It maintains its pitch really well. So I love that. At any rate, I started collecting all sorts of sheet music and learning to play all sorts of different songs. I actually play the ukulele on my drag show. I do Changes by David Bowie.
Oh, I love that.
It's one of the last numbers on the show.
Yeah.
And And I really enjoy doing that. And if I'm doing a recital now, I will play something on my ukulele. But what I would do at night before bed is just sit here in the living room with David and play, you know, 12, 13, 14 songs through. And he never needed music. He never needed words. He knew the words to everything. He had just this insane memory for lyrics. David died with Alzheimer's. And so even when his memory was going, he still remembered all those song lyrics, which is not unusual. It's a different part of the brain.
I know.
And it was wonderful to be able to do that. And towards the end, he'd say, wow, you really know how to play. When did you learn how to play that? And I'd say, oh, honey, a little while ago, you know. And it's very hard for me to play ukulele right now because I made a lot of ukulele videos during the pandemic because it was my way of continuing to perform for an audience. I made, oh gosh, I must have made 30 videos. And really, really loved it and loved sharing them. And they got a lot of good play, and that was wonderful. But when he started really getting ill in the last few years, it got harder to do that. Not because it was hard for me to play. It was just hard for me to play. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a little bit of a heartbreaker. And so actually towards the end of his life, I started playing more frequently. And then the last time I played for him was the night before he died. And because David died in hospice here at home, and I was up with him for 24 hours the night before he died. I read him poetry and I sang for him, and I played the ukulele and sang his favorite songs. And he was no longer conscious. But the hospice people were like, please keep talking to him. The hearing's the last thing to go. He hears you.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And it's hard for me now to think about playing, but it's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm about to actually do a cabaret show in the Berkshires next month for Barrington Stage. And I'm doing the very last show that David ever heard me sing.
Oh.
Died 2 weeks after. And it's going to be really hard to sing. You know, I'm going to do it because he would want me to.
Yeah. And he'll be right there.
Oh, no, he's always here.
Mm-hmm.
He's always here. He was the most important thing and most important person in my life. And he made me feel like I could do anything.
Yeah.
And when you find that person, oh my God, hold on, just hold on, because you'll never find that again. He made my career possible. I started singing professionally at 24. I met him at 30, and we were together for 25 years. David was 28 years older than me, and I had a husband with me everywhere. And fortunately, he also did a lot of shows with me in this country. It's lovely. Generally, if I said to the director, look, my husband's a super, can you find a role for him in this? And I actually had directors who created roles for him. He was very good on stage and he loved doing it.
Mm.
And that was one of the hardest things for him. The last show we did together was at Palm Beach Opera, and he had to remember some names and he could not. And it was so hard for him. We wrote everything out and we just kept working at it, and he did it. And he was great and he looked fabulous. That was wonderful. But even towards the very end, he would say, you know, do you think I'll ever be on stage again? He lived for that.
Wow.
He entertained people. He absolutely lived for it. And he was very good at what he did, no matter what iteration it was in.
Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing all of this with me. Saying I enjoyed it isn't enough.
Well, thank you.
Remember, if you want to go to Spanky's in Newfoundland, I'm your girl.
All right. We'll make a date.
I'm there.
We'll make a date. You know, I got a hankering for Scrapple. So
you've been listening to Catskill Character with today's guest, mezzo-soprano, ukulele player, and drag performer, Stephanie Blythe. Tune in next Saturday at 10:30 for more fabulous stories of Catskill characters. This is Donna Fellenberg. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Oh, trick-or-treaters.
Get the candy.
Trick-or-treat.
Look at these costumes. We've got a vampire.
And a witch.
And what are you?
Oh, I'm an apple pie.
Ah!
Radio Catskill has more tasty terror than you've ever seen at Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
That sounds like a lot of pie.
A frightful amount of apple pie.
Ah!
There's pie to eat, pie to buy, for ghouls and gourmets alike. You're sure to savor every bootiful bite.
That pun was kind of scary.
It sure was.
Apple Pie Palooza-ween. Frightfully good fun to support Radio Catskill. 2 to 5 this afternoon. Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Happy Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
It's all right if you wear a costume, too.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio.